For long enough about the extent of illegal mining in the old abandoned shafts of the once booming Witwatersrand goldfields to know that the people involved there were a danger not only to themselves but to the communities around the areas of the resources that they were exploiting. And where did it all start? How did it all go wrong? Well, some answers today from Professor Tracy Lynn Field, Professor of Law at Wits University. Tracy, thanks very much for joining us tonight on The Money Show. Where do you think it did all start to go wrong in terms of illicit mining and the communities that it has brought about?
Good evening, Bruce. Yes, I first heard about this problem about 20 years ago, which is when I started working at WITS, when one of my students first did a project that alerted me to these people living underground in the mining tunnels. But, you know, I think it's been coextensive with the decline of the gold mining industry and the lack of proper closure of mines. These people just haven't been properly accommodated with new skills, and so it's just been a ticking time bomb. But it's been going on for a couple of decades.
And that's the point, isn't it? I mean, this awareness goes back to the 1990s. There were plans to address it. There were meetings. There were documents. There was even proposed legislation to deal with the problem, but it, you know, typically didn't get off the ground.
So interestingly, the RDP didn't even mention artisanal mining, and the 1998 minerals policy spoke about it, but spoke about the need to control it. So I think the policy bias has been, you know, still in favor of large-scale mining and, to a lesser extent, small-scale mining, but artisanal mining has been neglected, and it's now very late in the day that we have a policy since end of March, but we have really no regulatory framework, and it's at the moment still a criminal activity.
And what, there are an estimated 30,000 people involved in illicit mining. And it's quite interesting, and this makes complete sense, actually. I would never have put the figure as that high, but we've had some of the richest gold deposits ever discovered that now lie abandoned because technologies, when they were abandoned, weren't very sophisticated and wasn't necessarily worth the commercial mines' efforts to keep exploiting the remaining seams. But then you also had tens of thousands of people laid off by the mines with the technical abilities and the skills, and many of those are probably the people who kept working informally, and many continue to do so as well.
You're absolutely correct. I mean, it's quite incredible that this Witwatersrand Basin produced 50% of all the gold ever mined. It's an amazing statistic. But also the labor force that mined that resource extended over the whole of Southern Africa. So it wasn't just South Africans, it was people from Lesotho, Zimbabwe, you know, the whole of Southern Africa. And so it's not just South Africans that have been affected, but the whole region with the decline of this industry. So, you know, what are they going to turn to in that kind of context?
And so one gets a sense of desperation. One also gets a sense then of massive opportunism, because this is actually a very well-structured industry. The Minerals Council's got it all figured out. And they've, the Minerals Council's got documents and the structure of how it works. They've got five or six levels within the structures. Mm. The Institute for Security Studies talks about the 30,000 people engaged in the process, the trade routes, the way in which the metal is processed.
Correct. And so that understanding of how the illegal, unregulated industry is organized is very important, because the people that are being arrested now are really just on the bottom tier. And so you need to start going up that tier. First of all, the gangs that control the people who actually go underground, and then above that, the buyers of the gold. So that's where I see the key intervention needing to take place. The national and regional, the pawnbrokers, the scrap metal dealers, that's where we need to start focusing to make sure that those operators are not unscrupulous.
Well, we know that they are. Many of them are, because this is the support mechanism. It's a very lucrative support mechanism. We've got regulation. I mean, Gwede Mantashe, he's the Mineral Resources and Energy Minister, came out with this small-scale mining policy earlier this year. And it says, look, the potential of artisanal mining as a livelihood strategy is huge. And in a country with the massive problems that we have, it is, you know, necessary to admit that there is an industry. It can pay for itself. If it could be regulated and managed, it may actually be a useful contributor to society. Then what Gwede Mantashe then adds into the mix, he says, but no, permits only for South Africans. And the moment he does that, because we're getting a sense that many of the people down in these mines doing dreadful work under awful conditions are not necessarily all South Africans.
That's correct. It is standard for this artisanal level scale of mining to be reserved for nationals. It's not something you don't find elsewhere in the world, but obviously it's a big problem here because a lot of the miners are coming from neighboring countries. So that is something we're going to have to tackle. And then there's a difference between formalizing and legalizing, and that is where I think the government needs to think carefully, because you're not going to solve this problem by having a myriad of laws. You need to shift. You know, there need to be economic incentives for miners to be aligned to the state and not to criminal syndicates. And I think that is the key problem that needs to be addressed. But I agree that it needs to be formalized as a livelihood strategy. There's many, it's not just men, it's women and children, women as well, but obviously children are also getting drawn into these activities.
There are entire communities of people who are existing in these spaces, and to try and deny that they're there is foolish. And the consequences tragically played out last week of a group of men, you know, who then exploited the opportunity that they saw present themselves with young women making a video, and then proceeded with this horrendous gang rape. And the most surprising thing is that we're surprised, because these stories, you know, this has been a ticking time bomb for us.
Yeah, my sense is that was the level two operators, the gangs, and there's speculation that some of these are involved with, you know, former defense forces, security operatives in neighboring countries. That, of course, is just speculation, but that's my sense. That's what we were dealing with there.
Thank you very much to Professor Tracy Lynn Field, Professor of Law at Wits University, pulling that story for us together for us. We act surprised. I mean, the biggest surprise out of the July riots last year is that it took so long for something like that to happen in South Africa. We're seeing all of the protests around Tembisa and other parts of Gauteng beginning to swell up. It's this time of the year. It's a time of deep frustration and, you know, deep poverty and, you know, no excuse for criminality. Of course not. Not for a moment. But we mustn't be surprised when, you know, you keep sweeping stuff under the carpet or stuffing it into the couch or whatever you do with it. And when it comes to light, you can't pretend to be shocked.